This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from Chevrolet. At Chevrolet, we bring people together with the things that matter to them most. Visit Chevrolet.gm.ca.
Welcome to Newfoundland and Labrador this week. I'm John Soper. Coming up, we'll have a report on Innu misgivings about developing more of the hydroelectric potential of the Churchill River. There are more public calls for long-term addictions treatment in St. John's. Ray Guy has a new book, and this time it's a Christmas tale. That's all to come. But first, changes are in the works for schools in St. John's. The biggest school board in the province has big plans for revamping schools in St. John's. The board released a draft plan this week that would see three schools close, four new ones built, and several others renovated. The goal? To get a better match between where families live in the greater St. John's area and the location of schools. Milton Peets chairs the board. He spoke with David Cochran on the St. John's Morning Show.
Now, you want to close three schools in the city centre. Tell me why you want to close Booth, McPherson, and I.J. Sampson.
Well, I guess we looked at, first of all, infrastructure. We looked at changing demographics within the city. And I guess to some degree we have overcapacity in some sections. So with that in mind, Booth being the type of a structure that it is, and I.J. Sampson been around a long, long while. Those were the two that, of course, we had on our plan last year. We added McPherson to it this year because we felt that those students could go into Bishop Abraham and therefore we would make a much tighter-knit school community.
So closing three, but you also want to replace four schools. So just talk about which ones you want to replace.
Well, of course, I guess the big numbers come along with Bishop's College and Holy Heart of Mary. It's fair to say that, again, both of those schools are very old infrastructure, have outlived, I guess, their purpose. Located in the city many years ago, back in the late 50s, early 60s, populations have shifted. Bishop's College, of course, now house most of their students come from the west end of the city. Mm-hmm. We felt at this time that it was strongly recommended and needed that we should move forward and accommodate the west end students. So hence was our reason for replacing Bishop's, I guess, with a new Bishop's. I guess when we get into Holy Heart of Mary, we have a number of issues around Holy Heart. You know, it doesn't have any green space there. Very limited bus accommodation, you know, traffic congestion. And again, if I just think back to my days here in the city, going to university, you know, this was sort of the center city. Today, our populations have shifted, and we felt, of course, along with that, it was time to replace this infrastructure, which is badly in need of replacement.
I just want to talk about Bishop's there for a second. You're talking about replacing a Bishop, so the existing school that is Bishop's College today will be shut down and you're going to build a brand new one somewhere in the West End. Have you got a location for that?
No. At this point, David, we did not get into a site selection. However, I think it would be fair to speculate that Bishop's would not be rebuilt on the site it is today. It would be relocated more in the West End of the city. That's the reason and the intent of doing it. So that's where we are with Bishop's.
Now, parents have been lobbying for this in the west end of the city quite heavily for the last little while. How much of an influence did that have on board members?
Well, I guess it's fair to say that the parents in the west end, David, as well as some of the MHAs, whose territory that is, they've been lobbying us. But when we looked at it a number of months ago, and of course last year when we briefly looked at it, we felt that, you know, Bishop's needed to be not only rebuilt but to be relocated to accommodate the greater school population. And of course we have PWC and Gonzaga here in the city as our center city schools, and because of that we looked at Bishop's. Well, it's time to move on, and I guess we should relocate it in the West End for all of the right reasons, but I commend the MHAs and the parents for lobbying at the same time.
Because you've really got this population trend where the school age kids now live on the edges of the greater St. John's area rather than in the middle, which is what the school system was really built to support, and it's sort of hollowing out now, isn't it?
Yes, yes it is. And, you know, in the center part of the city, I guess, and to some degree in the West End, our population in the schools are declining. Mm-hmm. Our great growth area in the St. John's metro area, of course, is in the East End. So, you know,
Airport Heights, that sort of thing.
Yeah, the Airport Heights and Torbay.
Yeah.
That area is really, really growing. We're very hopeful that what we're proposing as extensions and new schools in those areas will accommodate students in the future. But, you know, the Bishop's system, the Holy Heart system where they're located, doesn't really fit the match in the student community today.
Now, you're looking to completely redevelop Holy Heart. And I know from living here in the city, there's a lot of emotional attachment to that school. You've got things like an auditorium, a choral room, substantial cafeteria. People are going to protect that. Will the new Holy Heart have all the facilities that the current Holy Heart has?
Well, of course, in our recommendations, we have put forward a recommendation at this point as a draft that would include, of course, a new Holy Heart Auditorium. We realize as a board that is a strong attachment. You know, it's a tremendous asset here to the city, a tremendous asset to the schools. However, what will come out at the end of the day when government, I guess, looks at this picture is, I guess, not for us to judge. And at the same time, as we go through the public consultation process, I'm sure we will get some strong reaction to what we do with Holy Heart, to say the least. And I'm sure, David, as well, that the auditorium issue, the music facilities, the band room facilities there will become the focus. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think we have to look and move forward. If that means that we have to put Holy Heart in another location, which I'm sure we will. An auditorium is very, very essential, but I guess we'll have to wait and see how it plays out.
But, I mean, the school is one thing. The school community is sort of built around these facilities and the programs that come with them. You can't give a guarantee to the Holy Heart community that those will be preserved?
Well, of course, at the end of the day, it's government who gives the guarantee.
Right.
We are the ones who have put forth the plan. You know, times have changed, things have changed. We all want to protect what we have from the past. But I think we have to look at the greater good and the greater service that we can put forward, not only for the Holy Heart students, but for the whole of St. John's.
Now, on that, you want to renovate five existing schools, Beachy Cove Elementary, Beaconsfield Junior High, Mary Queen of Peace Elementary, Roncalli Elementary, and Virginia Park Elementary. All of this is going to come with a big price tag. Do you think the provincial government's going to come up with a check to get all this done?
Well, David, some of those renovations have to be done.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no question they have to be done. I just look at two quickly there because of time factors, Roncalli Elementary and Virginia Park. I mean, Virginia Park is a very, very close community-centered school. You know, a tremendous attitude on behalf of the parents and the teachers and students there, that it's a community-based school. We really want to redevelop Virginia Park for those reasons. As well, Roncalli is growing. It's an old school, and we need an extension like this year.
Yeah.
And we will put on a new extension, hopefully with government's blessing. But in doing so, down the road very shortly, we would hope to remove the old part that's there. And of course, it will become a completely new redeveloped school rather than building a new school structure.
Joan Burke did say to me at that news conference in Paradise not long ago that once you had a plan, the government would have money there. So we'll see if that's the case.
We're very optimistic. I guess if you don't ask, you never know what you will get.
Okay. Thanks for coming in, Mr.
Thank
Peach.
Thank you, David.
Milton Peach is chair of the Eastern School Board. There'll be lots of debate and consultation about the plans. So here's a taste of what's to come. David Cochran spoke with a couple of parents, starting with Sarah Colburn Penny. She's been lobbying for a new high school in the west end of St. John's.
Now, you were at the school board meeting last night. What was your reaction when you heard the news?
Oh, we were very pleased, of course. This was the significant step that we were looking for to take place. We heard from government that they needed to hear a recommendation from the school board before we could move forward. So we were very pleased to be able to have achieved that last night.
Well, you've got the recommendation, but there's still some key details that are missing. There's going to be a new site for Bishop's College, but it hasn't been decided. Does that raise any red flags for you?
No. I think we're fortunate that there are probably several viable options when it comes to location in the West End. So, you know, we'd have to look at the pros and cons of each potential site before we could promote one location. We haven't gotten that far yet. We simply wanted the recommendation, first of all.
Have you got a preference of where you'd like to see the school located?
No, as long as it's in the West End, so our children can stay in their community, right?
Now, you've got the recommendation you were looking for, but this is just the start of what's going to be a fairly long process. There's going to be hearings. The government's still going to have to come up with the money to implement all of this plan. So how confident are you that this recommendation is going to become a reality?
Well, we seem to be getting hints from governments that they are amenable. But, of course, you know, you're exactly right. Parents are looking for a commitment from government now to honor this plan with funding to make it a reality. I think we feel pretty optimistic about that, bus. We want a commitment in writing would be nice.
Okay, well, thank you very much for speaking with me this morning.
Thank you.
That's Sarah Colburn-Penny. She is a spokesperson for the West End High School Committee. Now we're going to move to the central part of St. John's, where the board wants to completely redevelop Holy Heart of Mary High School. Mary Byrne is co-chair of the school council, and she's not entirely happy with the plans, and she joins us on the line now. Good morning, Ms. Byrne.
Good morning.
What is it you don't like about the plans for Holy Heart?
Well, from the meeting that I attended last night, we heard that they're basically going to tear Holy Heart down and rebuild it somewhere else. And there, you know, you talk about the different schools and things, and Holy Heart structurally is a very sound school. It's it'll be 50 years old next year. They're going to have their anniversary next year. And but it was built really well, and it has the high ceiling, so it doesn't have the problems with air quality and things like that that they have at other schools. And also the board just spent, I think it was like $1 million redoing the roof at the school. They've put hundreds of thousands of dollars into the theater to bring it back to the level that it was at before. And I just feel that, you know, they've spent all this money on it and, you know, kind of to bring it up to the level that it should be. And the only real things that need to be done now are the electrical upgrade and new windows. So, you know, to tear something down and then to have to rebuild a new school just for those small things. And I was listening to Mr. Peach, and he was saying that their biggest concerns were lack of green space and the parking issues in front of Holy Heart. And I find any school that you go by, if you go by any school, if you go by Newfoundland Drive when, say, St. Paul's gets out at 2:30, you can't even get down Newfoundland Drive because there's actually very little parking at St. Paul's.
There's always traffic when school gets out.
When school gets out, or, you know, when the buses are all coming and going. I mean, that's, you know, a pretty common thing for any school, and it lasts for about 10 minutes, and then it's done. And, you know, so, and I, you know, I've never heard of any issues of safety concerns or anything like that. I mean, this is something new to us.
So you'd rather see this school get some more upgrades and renovations rather than a complete rebuilding?
Sure, because this school has so much to offer. And, you know, for me, it's not so much, you know, this sort of attachment to the school, because I grew up in Gander. I didn't go to Holy Heart. And, you know, my daughter is going to be finishing now this year. But it's not so much the attachment, is what this school offers. And, you know, from listening to him this morning, I can see that there's no guarantee they're even going to put the, you know, like the theater back, or they're going to put the choral room back. I didn't get a sense that there was any guarantee of that. You know, it's not just the choral room. There's a band room. There is a 911 fitness center that's state of the art, that's as good as any gym in the city. I mean, I go into gyms all the time with coaching and playing, and a lot of them have their gym equipment, you know, fitness equipment on their stages because they don't have the room to, you know, put it in. And Holy Heart has all that. So, you know, I'd like for the board to come in and see what Holy Heart has to offer and see it actually functioning day to day, and, you know, see what they're going to be tearing down before they go, you know, go ahead and do it. And I know there's a consultation process and all that, but, you know, it sounded very final to me this morning when I was listening to him, so I'm very concerned about it for sure.
Okay, Ms. Byrne, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Mary Byrne is co-chair of the Holy Heart School Council. We also heard from West End parent Sarah Colburn-Penny. I'm John Soper, and you're listening to Newfoundland and Labrador This Week. The Lower Churchill Hydro Project is now at the start of an environmental assessment that could take up to 3 years. But the race director may be ready to tell everyone to shut off their engines. Premier Danny Williams says before the province spends big bucks on project engineering, he wants to know whether the Innu are ready to accept the project. The Innu Nation says the key is a land claim settlement. But even with a land deal, some Innu oppose new dams on the Churchill River, especially near sacred sites at Muskrat Falls. Paul Piggott reports on the complexity of reaching a Lower Churchill deal.
Elizabeth Panashaway mixing bread in an Innu tent near Sheshajit. She's gathered a small group of Innu seniors here to talk about a recent trip to Gull Island, where the province wants to install a 2,000-megawatt hydro dam. Banashwe describes a barge that she saw. It was doing test drilling on the river.
I seen a small boat in the middle on the lake, on the Chuchu River, Mr. Shivo. And I just couldn't believe it. I didn't know that stuff, what he doing. Wind, chill on my wind. Hello? Jiguan?
It's the two sides of older Innu Lake Panashawe. Here tending the stove, she's Changwesh, a Shehejit senior and leader of canoe trips down the river. Then the cell phone goes off and she's Elizabeth again, the organizer and award-winning environmental activist.
When I went to helicopter myself, I look at Mr. Shibu, so beautiful. How do the government, they're going to make another dam? Just couldn't believe it. One woman said to me, Changwesh, when we went in helicopter, did you see a beaver? I can see beaver in there, he said.
The Upper Churchill Project flooded trap lines that belonged to Panashawe's father, and it submerged forever ancient Innu burial sites and meeting places. Even though the reservoir from a dam at Gull Island would be tiny beside the Smallwood Reservoir, Panashawe says any flooding would hurt. Her husband Francis Panashawe translates.
Well, she's saying that the caribou, everything that the animals are small or large or, you know, younger animals, they all be infected in that water when the Lower Churchill is flooded.
As Panashawe serves her bread, her son Peter Panashawe is just finishing up a call at the Innu Nation office in Sheshajit. Animals rank a little bit lower on the priority list for the vice president of the Innu Nation. Panashawe also has to worry about an exploding population of young and unemployed in his communities.
My mother, Elizabeth, and some of the elders look at it in the context it impacts on them emotionally today. And I completely understand that it's very painful to see a river that has sustained people, cultures. When my mother and elders see the river being flooded or they look at Upper Churchill, you know, how deeply scarred they are. But I have to look at it beyond that. 20 years from now, the people that are currently present that have emotional attachments to those particular lands will not be here. Well, what about those people that are coming behind them? Who's going to look after their interests and how do they protect their families and their children?
Panashawe says federal spending on First Nations is in decline. To survive, he says groups like the Innu need income from sustainable projects on their land. But first, they need to have clear land title, not an unresolved land claim. So Panashawe says there will be no hydro until there's a land deal.
If we let this project proceed without settling the land claims, we've lost all leverage that we would have had. For that reason, we're not least a bit at all interested in entertaining Lower Churchill without resolving our land issues.
It's a message already received at the Premier's office. In mid-November, Danny Williams met privately with Panashawe and Innu Nation President Mark Nui.
There's a critical point here beyond which we don't go or we do proceed. Preliminary work gets done, but then once you get to a front-end engineering stage, then you're starting to spend some significant dollars. So, I basically said to Mark and Peter, that look, the first major issue here is whether the land claim can be resolved between the province and the Innu. And I think if we should identify very quickly that if we can't get beyond that hurdle, then basically what we do is we can shut this down at this particular point.
The largest issue of contention is land ownership. The Innu Nation wants at least the amount tentatively agreed to with the former Grimes government, 20,000 square kilometres. But that's almost three times as much land as the Inuit got in their land claim settlement just 2 years ago. Williams says the Innu are asking for too much.
That's a land quantum that's just simply not acceptable to the provincial government. Now, having said that, that's not to say that we can't, reach a reasonable compromise.
But even if the province and the Innu can come up with a compromise and negotiate a land claim, the Lower Churchill is far from a go. Like Voisey's Bay, a major development on Innu land will require 50%+ of Innu in Labrador to say yes in a plebiscite. And that's where things get complicated again, according to Peter Panashawe. So far, Newfoundland and Labrador Hydro's concept is two dams, one at Gull Island producing 2,000 megawatts and a second at Muskrat Falls adding 800 megawatts to the proposal. But Panashawe says Innu have a spiritual connection to Muskrat Falls. It's a place that appears in many Innu legends, and some believe it's the place where the Innu shaking tent ceremony was last performed. That history could result in a no vote from the Innu, according to Pinashawe. It's not clear how dropping muskrat from the project would affect the province's development plans. Williams says he's still assessing that, but he does know that Innu seniors like Elizabeth Pinashawe don't want to see any hydro development at all.
She's saying that you probably would have a good idea if the project didn't go ahead with something else. It's too much damage for the earth and the people too.
It's a view that hydro is struggling to overcome, especially after one of its subcontractors sunk a tugboat in the river this fall. Hydro Vice President Gilbert Bennett stands on the shore of the Gull Island Rapids. With his back to the Deep River Gorge, Bennett points across the hill to where the south side of the Gull Island Dam would be built. He says hydro is doing everything it can to minimize impacts on the land here. In the long run, Bennett says a project here would have major environmental benefits.
We recognize that there are going to be effects, and they're going to be documented and studied through the environmental assessment process. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, this project, you know, has the capability to, you know, displace, you know, greenhouse gases from, you know, from fossil fuel uses and so on. And it's important to, you know, that we do have energy sources for our society, and that, you know, this project in particular, compared to other projects, has a relatively small environmental footprint.
Like Peter Pinashawe, Bennett has the bigger picture in mind. The question now for the Innu Nation and Hydro is whether or not Innu will see it that way when they're asked to vote on the fate of the project. At the Gull Island Rapids, I'm Paul Pigott.
The average stay for a drug addict at the Humberwood Treatment Center in Corner Brook is 21 days. It's the longest full-time program that the province has to offer. Drug addicts in Newfoundland and Labrador have to leave the province for longer-term treatment. In fact, this province is one of only two in Canada without a long-term drug treatment facility. PEI is the other. People in the addictions field in St. John's want to see that change. About 40 people braved a stormy night this week to voice their concerns. And here's some of what they said.
I worked in Labrador for a long time along the coast in these communities, and the problem is far more serious, and there is nowhere for these people to go. These outreach programs they have are not enough. I've heard of kids 8, 9, 10 years old killing themselves over issues with drugs and alcohol in their families. It is a disgusting situation up there, and it's being ignored. And a long-term place is what we desperately need. A place for 10 people to go, you could probably take 100 people or more out of one town in Labrador, even though, which would be impossible, but how much people, like, the people need help up there.
I had no intention of doing this this evening, but I'm a recovering addict. I spent time at Humberwood 10 years ago, and I completed an inpatient long-term program on the mainland. In my time there, my 45 days there, there were 10 other Newfoundlanders. So you talk about painting a picture. I do feel that there is a definite need for a long-term care facility in the province, for sure.
There was actually a kid in my school who overdosed while I was going through high school, and I was like, you know, what kind of idiot was this? He had it coming. Because I didn't understand that the very nature of an addiction is the loss of choice, and it is the loss of your own abilities.
I've had people, man, 11 and 12 years old, grade 5 and 6. They could name out all the drug dealers that were in the neighborhood. They could tell you where they lived. They could tell you who sold the coke, who sold the marijuana, who drank the booze.
I started when I was 11 years old. Out with all the bigger boys, you know? When I was 11, I was hanging around with 16, 17 years old, going out, robbing for them, and then in return, where I was the smallest one, can I get charged for it? They'll give me drugs for it, you know? What they had. I was young, I didn't know no better. Started taking it, you know? Getting right whacked and stuff, and then years down the road, I figured out that I had an addiction. Here I am, 16, and I still at it 24/7 every day. I need more. I just need more, a bit of everything, really. More support systems, more long-term situations that could actually help with this stuff.
Those are some of the people at a public meeting this week calling for a long-term drug addictions treatment center in St. John's. I'm John Soper, and you're listening to Newfoundland and Labrador This Week. We'll be right back. Award-winning Newfoundland humorist Ray Guy has a new book, Sammy and the Miracles of Christmas. It's illustrated by Labrador-born artist Boyd Chubbs. It's about a 10-year-old boy who lives in a Newfoundland outport. Guy says they're not your usual pre-Confederation Christmas tales. He wrote them more than 30 years ago when he worked at what was then the Evening Telegram.
The Christmas edition of the Telegram at that time, you'd weep for the number of dead trees that were sacrificed. It was a huge turkey of a thing. And they got the extra advertising, and they had to have stuffing, like to go in with the advertising turkey. And we were all called upon, required, to write these heartwarming, unquote, articles about Christmas at the mental hospital, Christmas at the TB sanatorium, Christmas at the orphanage, Christmas, oh, God. So this was my little rebellion of anti, you know, treacly, Christmassy stuff. And it's got two separate stories in there, Sammy and the Christmas Crow and Sammy and the Christmas Sculpin. And the house is always a shambles because Sammy's father is wonderful unhandy. He's the unhandiest person that ever was. So there's the usual big mess in the house around Christmas. Christmas didn't start after Thanksgiving or after Halloween. It was right up to Christmas Eve. Here's the Sculpin, the miracle of Sammy and the Christmas Sculpin, a bit of that. There was a strong stink of stove oil. The house was freezing cold, and two or three lengths of piping were down, and soot was over everything. Sammy's mother said, what in the world was she going to do with a rising of bread in her hands? Sammy's father said, if she couldn't help, don't hinder. Bits of the stove were took apart on the table. Uncle Wes and Aunt Lil were there from Grand Falls, and they were looking cross as the cats, they being Pentecost. Sammy's Nan wouldn't stay in her room. Dick Head from down the road bounced in with three parts of a bottle of rum in his pocket. Sammy, being in grade 5, knew when he was well off. He sidled out the door, and there wasn't even a cat to sling rocks at. So he dodged down to the stagehead for something to do. His old Connor pole was there on the wharf. With no thought, Sammy picked it up and dropped down the hook. No Connors this time of year, but something grabbed Holt right away. He hauled up a big old sculpin, ugly as sin. Awful mile for the time of year, said the sculpin. Hello then, hello then, hello then, said Sammy. Oh, do not be afraid, Sammy, for I am the magic Christmas sculpin. I don't care if you're Mr. Joyce Smallwood, says Sammy. You're going to get your guts jumped out. Oh, do not jump the guts out of me, Sammy, said the sculpin, and I will grant you wishes tree. Yes, I dare say you will, said Sammy, and commenced to jump the guts out of the magic Christmas sculpin. But on the third stomp, a pisen tarn on the sculpin's back went right up to the sole of Sammy's long rubber and into the heart of his foot. Ooh, that's tasty, that is, said Sammy with the pain. Every bit of strength seemed to go out of his legs. He had to crawl along by the time he got back to the house. What in the world, said Sammy's mother, once they got him on the settle. His leg is swole up and turned black, and there's red streaks going right up and down his grind. Pah, said Sammy's father. Nothing wrong with him. He's always coming down with something he come up with. That leg wants to be lanced, said Uncle Wes. Shut up, said Aunt Lil. Well, they go on in this condition. But I must say that Boyd Chubb's illustrations add a whole new dimension to the thing. He's brought in medieval elements and things I'd never have thought of. When Sammy is, I think it's in the hospital, some, you know, great medieval painter's macabre dance of death with these skeletons cavorting around the poor little creature. There's Mr. Joey Smallwood, previously mentioned, up in the clouds looking down with angel wings. There's Sammy on the cover. Now that to me, I hadn't thought of what he looked like or anything like that, but that is Sammy. He's got his cap on with the ear flaps and the little smile on his face, and he's... I shouldn't say it, but he looks a bit like me when I was 10.
Ray Guy is the author of Sammy and the Miracles of Christmas. It's published in Newfoundland by Boulder Publications. Now, there is a twist, though. Only 200 copies are available before Christmas. Boulder says the books were printed in India, and the rest of the shipment is on a boat somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean and, unfortunately, won't arrive until after Christmas. The That's it for this week's podcast. You can get in touch with us at cbc.ca by clicking Contact Us. Throughout the week, you can keep up with stories from around Newfoundland and Labrador at cbc.ca/NL. I'm John Soper in St. John's. Thanks for listening.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.